recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James and William Fink here. Actually, people are starting to call you Pastor William Fink now. I think the name ought to be appropriate because of your studies in the New Testament and, of course, the Old Testament as well. And I'd be willing to bet, Bill, there's probably not too many, how should I put this, Judeo-Christian pastors or Judeo-Christian theologians who understand the Greek as well as you do. What do you think? Am I overstating the case?
Well, there probably aren't any anymore.
Right.
Maybe 100 years ago there were a slew of them, but not anymore.
And, yeah, it's no longer required. In fact, studying the Bible is no longer required.
If they knew Greek well, they sure as hell didn't apply it to Scripture very well.
That's right. That's right.
I think it's just a matter of not wanting to buck the authority.
Yes. Yes.
Not wanting to go against the grain. Not wanting to be the upstart.
Right.
In a lot of cases, anyway, it has to be. I can't believe that many learned men didn't look at verses like 2 Thessalonians 3:5, I think it is, and noted something serious is wrong.
Okay, what's wrong there?
Well, that's where the King James says that not all men have faith, but Paul says that the faith is not for all. I mean, that's like the most blatant verse because it's only like four words.
Yes.
It's right. Four words and you can't screw them up.
Right, right. Well, I guess that statement is true that not all men have faith, you know.
That's not what it says.
Yeah, but that's not what it says. Right. So at least it didn't make up a lie.
Have is not there. Have is not there, and man is not there.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so, in other words, the translators, they make things up, and they don't bother to correct them, do they?
Well, yeah, and nobody, I don't think anybody wants to buck the Trinity Established Church.
Right.
I mean, the Reformers went into a lot of things, but they really didn't get into that because I think that, you know, Yahweh provides insight.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
And when he wants to pull the veil, it's pulled. It's not going to be pulled 1 second before that.
Right. Yeah, so we've got a situation with the original Hebrew and Greek. And let me just put it this way, in my opinion, the original Hebrew and Greek scriptures were inspired by Yahweh, and in fact, most of the Old Testament prophets say things like, I was in the Spirit, and, you know, therefore the word of Yahweh came to me, okay? And they took dictation. That's literally how we're supposed to understand the writing of the Hebrew Old Testament, okay?
And the Book of Revelation.
And certainly, I was just going to say, the Book of Revelation, likewise, okay? But most of the New Testament is simply eyewitness testimony. Wouldn't that be the case? And certainly the apostles wouldn't lie, would they?
Well, right. They had no reason to lie.
Yeah.
There was no reason at all for the gospel writers to make anything up.
Yes. And it's quite likely that they were inspired in many cases because we found that in certain cases they make statements that, were simply, well, for example, in the case of Paul, where he prophesies the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans.
Absolutely.
How
could
he have known that?
That's absolutely an inspired statement.
Yes. Totally
Yahweh
inspired.
Will crush Satan. Yahweh will crush the adversary under your feet shortly.
Right.
There's no way around that having to do directly with 70 AD.
Yes.
And Paul wrote that about 12 years before it happened.
Right, right. And certainly the Book of Revelation is a long series of prophecies that certainly John, when he took the dictation from Yahshua, Messiah, in the Spirit, he could not have understood. In fact, he did not understand what he was writing down.
No, absolutely not.
Yes.
I mean, he may have understood some of the symbolism from the Old Testament.
Yes.
But those prophecies hadn't unfolded yet, and we're lucky we could see them after the fact, never mind before.
Right. And I've made the statement that, in fact, the Book of Revelation is one of the best translated books of the New Testament because the translator, the King James slew of translators, I think there were around 40 of them with many Jews involved as well, they were simply doing their best to translate the words. And since it was all prophetic and very little doctrine, their worldview, or their how should I put it? Their well, certainly their perspective, but their slant, you know, their prejudices were not involved in translating the Book of Revelation because it was so far afield from what they're normally used to translating that they couldn't do that.
Well, and that's why I think that a lot of the prophets are also reliable.
Yes.
And
there you
even
go.
In the Masoretic text, because the Jews really didn't understand them.
That's right.
And
that's
and it. It can be shown that the New Testament, I mean, sometimes it's usually closer to the Septuagint, but sometimes it's closer to the Masoretic text. We can't throw it out.
Yes.
But the prophecies were not understood.
Right.
And we have the way that the four beasts and Daniel said, Daniel chapters 2 and 7, the way that history unfolded, it's unmistakable.
Yes.
That they're the four kingdoms of, you know, Greece, Rome, Medo-Persia,
yes.
And Babylon,
yes.
And later on, the papacy in Daniel chapter 7 is being discussed.
Right.
And it's unmistakable when you match that to history that that's what Daniel was
yes.
portending.
Yes, exactly.
However, in the Septuagint, a lot of that language, because the interpreters from Hebrew and the Greek had to make interpretations of it in order to translate it,
yes.
it's not as clear.
Right.
It's just not as clear in the Septuagint. And we need both books. There's no doubt.
Yes.
And more. I mean, the Dead Sea Scrolls and Josephus, too.
Yes. Oh, I fully agree. Yeah, we can't throw away the Masoretic text in spite of the, perturbations that...
Right. And some of the Messianic prophecies are definitely botched up in the Masoretic text. There's no doubt. Some of the Psalms just have little chunks missing.
Right.
Some of the historical books have little pieces missing.
Yeah, and in fact, some of them have major pieces missing.
Well, That's in a couple of places that's true also.
Yeah, yeah.
But we need every resource we have. I mean, for want of a real Hebrew manuscript, the Masoretic text, we're more or less stuck with it. I mean.
Right, and we have bits and pieces coming from the Dead Sea Scrolls and from other sources. But by and large, I would say that the Hebrew scriptures are inspired. In fact, everything in archaeology so far and we've had in the 1990s with computerization, we've had a tremendous addition to knowledge of archaeology. All of it has verified the Bible, every last drop of it. Nothing that has come about recently has, said anything contrary to biblical statements. Nothing.
No, nearly every discovery, like the Silver Scrolls, were discovered about 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
There were little prayers inscribed in these little silver amulets that looked almost originally looked like scrolls.
Yeah, right.
And they were found buried at a layer of strata in Jerusalem that had to date to the first destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians.
Okay.
No doubt they date to 600 BC.
Okay.
I mean, there's very few, there's no science that could dispute that.
That's right.
And these are little prayers from Numbers and Deuteronomy that have the name Yahweh, the Tetragrammaton, in them.
Yes.
And are written in a Paleo-Hebrew script.
Yes.
This is a discovery 5 years ago. It just fortifies everything that we know. And 99% of the archaeological discoveries do.
Now,
and the other
1%
are just misunderstood.
You know what really happened, Bill? Some guy from New Mexico invented those and planted them under the ground so that it would eventually be discovered by some stupid architect. I mean, archaeologist.
Well, yeah, right. A lot of people, you know, some idiots might concoct stories like that.
Right.
But the truth is that you're not going to stand in Jerusalem with a spade without the Jews breathing down your neck immediately.
Yes.
See what's going on.
Yeah. And so I am still utterly amazed by the Bible. It just amazes. The more I study it, the more it amazes me how accurate the histories are and the prophecies. Once you understand that the Jews are not the Israelites of the Bible and that we Caucasians are the Israelites of the Bible, then the prophecies make absolute 100% sense. They absolutely do. And, my appearance yesterday morning on the R.J. Hender show, I quoted from Leviticus 26, the seven times prophecy, going from 745 B.C. to 1776 A.D. Well, R.J. Hunter just thought that was awesome. It was awesome that the first Christian republic on the planet was prophesied in Leviticus chapter 26. Okay? Of course, you're not going to get anything like this from non-identity scholarship. You just aren't.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. It's just, it's incredible what the Bible contains once you properly understand it. And as we've been showing here in the book of Luke, because we've been doing two seed line in the New Testament, I think last week we ended at Luke 21:28, correct?
Yes.
Is that where we ended?
Yes, we're right at 21:29, parable of the fig trees.
Before we get in, oh, actually, I just thought of something. I forget where I read about this, concerning the antiquity of the Daniel's book and his prophecies, because people have said that, well, these prophecies are so accurate, especially the one concerning the 70 weeks, okay, that people have said, well, this, no one could possibly have predicted this.
Right. This is always called into question.
Yeah, right. So the book of Daniel can't possibly be as old as people say. It couldn't possibly have been written in, you know, what, 580 B.C., whenever he was in Babylonian captivity, leading up to 539 B.C., when Belshazzar was beheaded by Darius the Mede, okay? He couldn't have written that stuff in those days. It had to be written later, right?
Right, but the truth is that even though some of the some of the historical figures are well known from Greek writers such as Herodotus and Thucydides and Xenophon.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from that, Daniel had insight into ancient Babylonia that the Greeks did not have.
Okay.
That was lost to us. And much of it was lost to us until they dug it out of the ground in the 1920s.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, that's my first argument. Now, my second argument would be this. Daniel is known and exists in the Septuagint to at least the 3rd century
okay.
B.C.
Okay.
There's no doubt that Daniel existed in the 3rd century B.C. And when Ptolemy Lagai had the Septuagint translated from Hebrew into Greek. And even if Daniel's prophecies only date to the 3rd century B.C. and Daniel didn't write them, whoever wrote them was pretty damn good.
Yes.
Because they're all on the money 300 years out.
Right.
Okay, so they weren't told about 550 years ahead of time.
Yeah.
They were only told about 300 years ahead of time.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
You know, the coming of Christ is dated
yeah.
to the day from,
right.
from 526, 527 B.C. to 32 A.D. The crucifixion is dated.
Yes. Yes.
By Daniel.
That's
it's
right.
very clear.
It's predicted. Exact
it's absolutely
year.
Predicted.
Yes.
So, so I mean, just little things like that, and there's a lot more in Daniel that can be shown to have come to pass.
Right.
When
right.
Daniel said it would come to pass.
That's right. That's
however, right. just that alone should be a wake up call to all the clowns that dispute Daniel.
Yes, that's right.
Because if you predict something 1 year ahead of time or 300 years ahead of time, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah. But if your prediction is accurate, then obviously Daniel's were. And he correctly identified those four different beast systems. He
absolutely.
He predicted and that the Greek empire would be divided into four parts, which it was. Okay.
And even in 300 B.C., when this, or well, maybe it was like 270 B.C. when the Septuagint translation was conducted.
Yes, right.
Rome did not become an empire until the second century.
Right.
Okay, it had yeah. no control. It conquered Palestine in about 78 B.C., I believe.
Right, right.
Or thereabouts. And,
right.
And all the way up to the Euphrates River after
and,
that.
And
however, Rome didn't have a second capital until the time of Constantine.
Okay, yes, yes.
And the last emperor to rule both, you know, the East and the West, I think, was mm-hmm. Theodosius I, which is two generations after Constantine, three generations after.
Right.
I mean, and Daniel clearly implies or infers that,
right.
You know, Rome had that empire, that fourth beast empire, had two legs.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of clues in Daniel. It's definitely a book inspired by God.
Yeah. And there's no way anybody reading that could have any idea what the two legs mean. until the Rome split into two halves. the Eastern Empire and the Western Empire.
Right,
no,
and the division of Alexander's empire into four pieces, and that happened in history.
Right.
There's a lot of things in Daniel. I mean, we could go through and do the Book of Daniel in this series.
Yeah, we probably should. We probably should. You know, the reason why we should, Bill, is because the Book of Daniel says at the very end, or near the very end, I believe it's the 10th chapter, seal up the book until the time of the end.
Right.
You know,
I've tried like hell to understand Daniel chapter 12. It's very obscure to me.
Yeah.
And the Book of Revelation, and a lot of people confuse that with the Book of Revelation.
Okay.
Book of Revelation is not sealed.
No, it isn't.
Only the Book of Daniel, the end of the Book of Daniel is sealed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so we should do that and unseal it, because we are in the end times, and it's supposed to be unsealed in the end times. Okay, maybe we should do that next, right? Okay, but here, I recall, and I can't think of the source of it, because this is just so fascinating, that right after Alexander built the causeway and attacked, Tyre. The island of Tyre, because what was left of Tyre was simply left on the island, and the mainland portion of Tyre had already been overthrown. Okay.
Yes, that was destroyed by the Babylonians.
Right, and then they figured, well, nobody can attack us because there's this sea between the island and the mainland. So what Alexander did, he just had his men start building a causeway from the mainland to the island.
Yes, he did.
Yeah,
it's only about a quarter mile.
Yeah. And he built a bunch of, I guess, Trojan horses, for lack of a better word, towers on wheels that the
they had all kinds of machines that they would use in warfare.
Siege engines, they call that kind of thing. Yeah. And they were tall enough to scale the walls of Tyre. And he defeated Tyre that way. Okay. They never thought anybody could beat him, but however many months it took him to build that causeway, That's what he did, and he overthrew Tyre.
I think it may have taken about 9 months, the whole operation.
Yeah, and that entire scenario, that the city of Tyre would be overthrown in stages, was also prophesied in the Bible.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, so anybody who doubts the efficiency and effectiveness of biblical prophecy simply has not read the Bible or doesn't appreciate it, you know? And now, in addition, this is the fascinating part. After Alexander got finished with that, he set his sights on Jerusalem, which is just a few, 100 miles south of Tyre, something like that. But instead of attacking the city of Jerusalem, he was invited to go there, and the priest showed him the Book of Daniel.
And that's recorded in Josephus.
Right. And in the Book of Daniel, he read about himself.
Yes.
Okay.
And they even invited him into the temple and showed him the sacrifice to Yahweh.
Right. He recognized himself as that second beast.
Yes, he did.
Yes. And so he was so impressed by the Book of Daniel that he decided not to attack Jerusalem and went on his way toward the east.
Well, they understood. You know, it's very clear in Daniel where he tells Nebuchadnezzar, interpreting the dream, recorded in Daniel chapter 2, you are the head of gold. And to be followed would be Media Persia, followed Babylon with the hegemony over the Near East.
Yes.
And that was two arms of silver.
That was the second beast.
So the Alexander being the third would follow naturally.
That's exactly right. And he recognized himself, knowing the history of Babylon and Medo-Persia, because he defeated the Persians, okay? He recognized that these prophecies were about him.
And, you know, he defeated the Persian Empire with 40,000 men.
Really? That's not
40,
too many.
40,000 men.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it was attributable to his fighting techniques that he was able to easily defeat many armies along the way, okay?
Well, it's speculated that Philip of Macedon got the idea from the story of Xenophon and the 10,000.
Okay.
The Anabasis is a famous story.
All right.
Where a group of 10,000 Greek mercenaries go with a man named Darius, who was the Persian governor of the westernmost Persian district of Anatolia. They go into his hire, and they go to Babylon
okay.
to defeat a king named Cyrus in 406 B.C.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, the 10,000, they get there. The first day of battle, Cyrus kills Darius's brother.
Uh-huh.
Who he had appointed to a regional governorship, who then turned around and tried to overthrow his own brother.
I see.
Cyrus kills him, and this Cyrus is, it's Darius.
Darius.
His name was Darius Nathus.
Okay.
Meaning Darius the Bastard.
Okay.
Okay, that's what it means.
Okay.
And Darius Nathus killed his brother the first day of the battle.
Okay.
Now the 10,000 Greeks are stranded there.
Uh-huh.
Their leader's dead. The other Babylonian forces on their side of the coin flee and defect to the other side, and 10,000 Greeks are stranded alone in a hostile land.
Right.
And Darius Nathus gives them an ultimatum to lay down their arms.
Oh, wow.
And,
okay.
and be his friends.
Okay.
Well, they figure out, well, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Right, right. We trust the
side. The last thing they're going to do is lay down their arms.
Yes.
So they actually fought their way back to Greece.
Ah, okay.
And about, according to Xenophon, I think about 8,000 of them made it.
Oh, wow. Good odds, yes.
So that, with that history, the March of the 10,000, they actually figured that they could defeat the Persian Empire with not much more than that.
That's right.
And Alexander the Great went and defeated it. He conquered the entire, all the way to the Indus River with 40,000 soldiers.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure he won some onto his side on the way, but he also probably lost a lot, and he made fortifications along the whole way, and there's a secret history to that. The secret history, the unrecorded or the barely recorded history, and this might be considered speculation by some, but there's pretty good evidence supporting it, is that the Jews based in Babylonia had controlled the gold and silver exchange between India and the West.
That doesn't surprise me.
Okay.
Yes.
And what was going on was that silver was trading at 7-1 for gold in the West, but at 20-1 for the East.
Okay.
So the Jews in Babylonia were buying all the gold they could with silver in the West and selling it in the East.
Yes.
And getting 20 pieces to one in the East for the silver, for the gold.
Right, so they're making a killing, yeah.
And they were making a killing between the two sides.
Right, you know, typically that's what the Jews always do.
Absolutely, and Alexander had to get control of that route to stop the West from bleeding precious metals.
Right, right, yes, yes. That makes a lot of sense.
And that's what was going on, and that's probably why he died in Babylon.
Okay. Is this kind of the kind of thing that's going on between China and America today?
Absolutely.
That's right.
You know, they bled England for all they could and threw England on the pyre after World War II, and now they're bleeding America for all they can.
Yes.
And they'll throw America on the pyre.
That's right.
Maybe after an Iranian war.
Yes.
Or regardless, I mean, that ball's already been put in motion.
Mm-hmm.
And they're pumping up the China currency, and they're pumping up, and it's, you know, it's a parasite feeding on one cadaver after another.
Right, right. Pretty soon there won't be any living, there'll all be corpses and nothing for the parasite to feed on, right?
Well, right.
Yeah.
It's like, where do they go next?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they could bleed China for a couple hundred years, though.
Yeah, they probably could.
I mean, it's a huge population. It's a huge nation.
Yeah,
Yahweh's not going to let it go that long.
No,
because Yahweh promised us in Daniel 7:26, or is it 7:28, that, you know, the saints of the Most High would receive the kingdom forever.
Yes, yes.
And that's the period we're in.
Yeah, and the Chinese have to have a market to sell their goods, otherwise they don't have an economy. And all the economies around them are dying.
The Chinese people are not the consumer society that we are.
That's right.
And the average Chinaman in his rice paddy never will be.
That's right.
I mean, they have only a small, maybe 2% of the population is cosmopolitan.
Right.
And has adopted American culture.
Judaized.
Well, right. Judaized is a perfect, it was a perfect name for it.
That's right.
You know, there's such a small percentage of the population. The rest of that society doesn't care about the consumer goods that
they
produce.
Don't. Yeah, well, they're lucky to make it through the day. You know, the way that lifestyle is.
And they actually, you know, we are deceived about Asian intelligence. We are extremely deceived about Asian intelligence.
Okay.
The average Asian person isn't anywhere near as intelligent as the average Caucasian.
Okay.
Their average IQ, their IQ numbers are, the IQ numbers that we're given by the media here in the West, they measure the IQs of the elite,
the Americanized,
of the Asian people.
The Americanized Orientals.
Right.
The ones who've gone to college and stuff.
Right. Well,
yeah.
Well, only a certain percentage of them can attain that.
That's right.
And it's the upper crust of Oriental society,
yeah,
whose IQ we get.
That's right.
But then when they measure American IQs, you know, they go to Harlem and they go to the trailer parks and
right,
they go everywhere where, yeah, average unlearned people live and include those numbers in.
Right.
Well, go to the rice paddy and measure some IQ.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Exactly. Okay, very good. Yeah, Patricia says the ones that were smart got out of China.
Yeah, they measure their IQs.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't compare to societies well. If,
yeah,
China and Japan, if their IQs were as high as ours, why haven't they created the culture?
Right. Exactly.
They never created the culture. Everything they have now,
yeah,
that's worth keeping comes from us.
So our brethren says we receive the cream of the crop from Asia. The vast majority of peasant serfs remain. And then he's got a whole list of statistics here. Thank you, Brian. I'm not going to quote all these statistics, but I get your point. Yeah, so, you know, obviously we're being lied to because they have to pretend that the white race is not the most intelligent. Just look where all of the technology in the world comes from, folks.
Absolutely.
You know.
Not only the technology. Compare Western art. And I don't mean Jewish art.
Yes, right.
I mean Western art.
Mm-hmm.
Compare Caucasian art to Oriental art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't even come close.
Right.
It doesn't. It's not even comparable.
Yeah. Well, music,
and their music is flat.
Yeah.
And it's not even comparable.
Yeah.
They can't create a symphony. Some of them learn how to play the cello, but they can't create a symphony,
yeah,
an orchestra, and a whole heritage of that.
Right, right.
They just can't do it. They can't create technology. They don't create our technology.
Yeah, yeah.
We create our technology. Pull the plug on us. They,
right,
have no more technology. It's gone in three generations.
Yes, yes. So basically, they're good imitators. They can imitate what we do, but they don't have the creative ability that the white race doesn't, and many Orientals have even admitted this. You know, it's simply a factor of racial diversity that the white race has these abilities and other races don't. You know, and,
absolutely. But
yeah,
we've also invented other things that they've never invented that aren't creative.
Yes.
Like calculus.
Yes.
That's not a creative skill that created calculus. That's an analytical skill.
Right. 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 That comes from a white race. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Finally here, Sword Brethren says, Orientals have never given the world any political institution or ideal worth emulating. And of course, that's true for all non-white races. Only the white race has produced a constitutional republic.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no other race has ever approached anything like it. Okay. All right, well, here, we spent the first half hour analyzing, the people of the book, okay, and the history. And this is fascinating stuff, but let's get back into Luke, okay?
Absolutely.
Right, so Luke chapter 21, verse 29. And he told them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they come out in leaf, you see for yourselves and know that the summer is already near. Okay. Now, it's not just about the fig tree. It's about all the trees. Aren't these?
Right. And it's trees in the Bible represent races of people.
That's right.
It's clear. It's not only clear in Genesis chapter 3. Which, you know, alone, standing alone, people might want to debate that.
Yes.
But also Judges chapter 9 and the parable of the trees. Ezekiel chapter 31, where it says that the Assyrian is the tallest cedar in the forest.
Yeah, the biggest tree. Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's people are compared to races of trees throughout the Bible.
That's right.
And this fig tree, it didn't produce and it didn't throw forth its fruits,
mm-hmm,
before 70 AD.
That's right.
And it was destroyed in 70 AD.
Yes.
That was the 3.5 years of and casting it out of the garden.
Okay.
And that's what happened then after the mission of Christ.
Okay. Yes.
But now that same fig tree, which is that cursed fig tree that
yes.
he cursed in the way, now it is shooting forth and producing its rotten fruit
yes.
all over the place.
Exactly.
And so are all of the non-Israelite, non-Adamic races.
Right, right. Well, here's another verse that totally disproves the teaching that Jesus loves everybody. If he loved everybody, he would have tried to convert this fig tree, wouldn't he?
Absolutely, but he hates everybody, and people are marked for destruction.
That's right.
That's all over the Bible.
That's right.
Just not all over church theology, because they just skip that half.
That's right. Okay, verse 31. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I say to you, this generation, and I'll ask you how that word should be properly translated.
Well, it has to be rendered here race.
Okay.
And not as first. You know, there were 40 years. He says, you should probably finish the race.
Yes.
This race shall not escape.
Yes.
Until all these things come to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, it was almost 40 years between the crucifixion.
Yes.
And the destruction of Jerusalem.
Right.
38 years by my chronology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the children of Israel spent 40 years in the desert. Why? So that nobody from that generation would make it to the other side.
Yes.
So here they're not spending 40 years so that they and they will still be there.
Yes.
I mean, most of the people alive during the crucifixion were dead already.
Yes.
And the ones that were adults surely were.
Yeah.
At the time that the Romans destroyed Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which affected the next generation.
Sure.
And the one after that.
Yeah.
Now, here, for that reason alone, this has to mean race.
Yes.
It can't mean generation.
Right. So truly I say to you, this race will not, what's the correct word, pass away, it says here in the Revised
Escape.
Standard. Escape.
I translated escape.
This...
And the, you know, the word, it literally means to pass by.
Okay.
And or to pass away, and I've translated it escape because of the context.
Okay. It will not escape until all has taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And, of course, we've been discussing the accuracy of these prophecies, up until this point. Okay, very good. Verse 34. But take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and cares of this life, and that day come upon you suddenly like a snare. Okay, and, of course, this speaks to our time as well. Not just 70 A.D. For it will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the whole earth. So it is clearly... Go ahead.
I have a few things I want to say about this.
Okay.
First, you know, where Christ says that these words of mine shall by no means pass away.
Okay.
You know, that may have seemed like an idle boast to people that heard it at the time.
Could be, yeah.
you know? And,
yeah.
And in today's world, we can see it as an assurance of the truth of the God of the Bible and of his word.
Yes.
Because we still have those words. He made that boast
yeah.
as a humble man standing in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have those words.
Yes.
And we still have an entire civilization built on Christian principles.
Yep.
That alone proves the deity of
yeah.
the God of the Bible.
Yeah.
The truth of the fact of the matter, that alone is should be enough proof.
Yes.
That he can make a boast like that, and he's not a king.
Yes.
I'd like to put things in perspective.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, I want to quote a poem, a portion of Percy Blythe Shelley's Ozymandias.
Okay.
To contrast this to. And this is Ozymandias is actually another name for the pharaoh Ramses.
Oh, okay.
And he put an inscription in the city on a giant statue of him. And Blythe Shelley says, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Now, this verse was written commemorating a boast of Ramses.
Okay.
Found on a broken statue in a desert. where there's little else to be seen.
Yeah, okay.
So the poet continued by saying, "Nothing besides remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare."
Yeah.
And when Ramses had his words inscribed, people surely believed that they would endure.
Yeah.
He was a great king. But where are they now?
Mm-hmm.
And Christ makes it what might be seen to be an idle boast.
Yeah.
And where are his words now?
Well, it's
everybody
interesting,
has.
Too, that the Jews have been trying to destroy his words for the last 2,000 years. And hard as they try, they can't destroy him.
Well, right. But you're exactly right. And Christ was a humble man, who the son of a carpenter, right?
Yeah. Yeah, right.
And Ramses.
He's the son of a steel magnate.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
And that's just to put that in perspective and to contrast it, because there are many places, and we take them for granted being Christians,
yeah,
that Christ boasts that his words are going to endure forever, and his words are going to do this, and his words are going to do that. And 2,000 years ago, people may have thought he was nuts, but we still have them.
Right.
And they're written all over the world.
Yes.
And they're kept by people all over the world.
Right.
That proves the divinity of Christ,
of
God.
There's simply no doubt. This is a prophecy. It's just another prophecy that has held up, the biblical prophecy that has held up. And now in verse 34, we're counseled not to let our hearts be weighed down with the cares of this world. And yet, isn't that where exactly modern Judaic Christianity is?
Well, that's also a lot of identity people.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah.
You know, the whole fear of the week club. What's Obama doing to us today, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen, and the other thing's going to happen. It just drives me nuts.
Yeah, right.
And yes, it's the whole Judeo-Christian world also.
Yeah.
Yeah. All they care about are the cares of this world.
And go ahead.
To read, I'm sorry, I'll let you read through verse 36.
Yeah, okay. Let me read verse 35 again. For it will come upon all who dwell upon the face of the old earth, and suddenly, from the previous verse, verse 36, but watch at all times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that will take place and to stand before the Son of Man.
Now, this is why Paul taught the imminent return of Christ.
Okay.
And, you know, a lot of commentators and the Paul bashers, they criticized Paul for teaching that.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's been 2,000 years. Why was he teaching that he was going to come right away?
Right.
Well, the judgment of God has not been withheld over the last 2,000 years anyway. It's been unfolding all through the centuries.
That's right.
But since Christ wanted his people to remain sober and vigilant and ready for anything, including his return.
Yes.
And that's so that they would not be found, they would always be found doing good,
right,
and not doing evil.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul's teachings were absolutely in harmony with that spirit.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter if Paul thought that the actual return of Christ would be immediately or in 3,000 years.
Yes.
We're always to be ready,
right,
and doing good works and doing what we're supposed to be doing for our kinsmen.
Well, as we found out, I think it was in the previous chapter, where Yahshua talks about the days of Lot too, but the days of Noah before the flood, that if we become like those people who were marrying and giving in marriage and being like everybody else, then we wouldn't be ready.
Absolutely not.
We have to be ready.
Right. And all those people out partying with Satan, partying with the Jews,
right,
the people in Vegas, the people in Manhattan.
There you go. Las Vegas. There you go. All right, verse 37. And every day he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and lodged on the mount called Olivet. And early in the morning, all the people came to him in the temple to hear him. I have to turn the page here. Okay, and that's the end of Luke chapter 21.
And this situation must have really vexed the Pharisees.
Okay, the parasites, I know.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's where the word comes from.
Yes, right. I read your mind.
Actually, I can explain where the word comes from, and it doesn't, but that's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so to finish your thought, I'm sorry I interrupted you there, about the Pharisees here.
Yes, that must have really ticked them off.
Okay.
ticked. They're
right.
Another parasite.
Exactly.
Christ had the ear of all these people who arose and woke up early for him to hear him every morning in the temple.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody wanted to hear the Pharisees, right?
Right.
I mean, they want to listen to Yahshua.
Right.
And that situation alone would really it would really upset the authorities, the people in power.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think it's interesting, too, and again, all these parallels between the early Christians and, John and Jesus and the apostles and the impression they were making on the people at that time, the Christian identity movement really parallels that today. Because we're not quite at the point where we're making a major impression, but we are catching the attention of the Pharisees. Okay? We are catching the attention of the Pharisees of the modern world.
Well, yeah, when they send out their kids to picket our little gathering.
That's right. There you go. You know, we're not quite at the point yet where we have huge crowds listening to us, but I think that day's coming. I think that day's coming. All right. Luke chapter 22, verse 1. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called the Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people. Please analyze that first verse there, or first two verses.
Well, it was the same reason why they didn't really want to kill John the Baptist outright.
Uh-huh.
They feared an uprising of the people against them. Their entire existence relies upon the show of authority that they have.
Yes.
And they don't, if they upset too many of the people, they will be upset, and the Romans
mm-hmm.
won't put up with it.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans won't allow them to tyrannize their people.
Right.
And as long as they're popular with the people, these religious leaders, then they're popular with the Romans.
Yes, yes. And so we find out that they're, number one, there's jealousy from the end of chapter 21. There's tremendous jealousy on the part of these scribes and Pharisees. And also they know that what Yahshua is teaching the people is more interesting and, relates to their lives more than whatever the Pharisees are teaching. And they're not teaching the law of Moses, that's for sure.
Right, and one of Yahshua's prime teachings, and it's evident over and over in Matthew 23, and it is that the Pharisees have no real authority.
That's right.
That their traditions, that the traditions of the elders are all wrong.
Yeah,
and all of their authority is pretense and pretending.
Yeah. And just like Judaism today, it's all steeped in rituals.
And Catholicism.
Yes, yeah. But Judaism is by far the worst. It's all rituals. Okay? There's very little doctrine other than the fact they teach Jews to be supremacists, and they're thinking towards Goyim. Okay?
Right. Their entire doctrine revolves around compound interest.
Yeah, that's right.
Miracle of compound interest.
Yeah, right. There's a miraculous compound interest. And there's no Bible study. There's no Bible study in Judaism, none whatsoever. People assume that there is, but there's none. Okay, the average Jew knows less about the Bible than the average Judeo Christian. If they study the Bible at all, it's the Talmudic interpretations they get from their rabbis, and that's it. Jews don't have any interest in reading the Bible.
Everything that's read in the Pentateuch, or I should say in the Torah, is perverted in the Talmud.
That's right.
It's perverted in the Mishnah.
That's right. And the Kabbalah, it's all perversion, every last bit of it. All right, now, speaking of perversion, then Satan entered into Judas, called Iscariot, who was of the number of the 12.
Right, and I have to discuss this verse, and later on, in a couple of paragraphs, it'll be discussed again, probably.
Yeah.
But where Satan entered into Judas, it doesn't really require, the Greek here does not really require a supernatural event be understood.
Okay.
And that's because the word entered into,
It's
isercomahi.
Okay.
And it's a word which appears approximately 190 times in Scripture.
Uh-huh.
And it's literally to go in or into, to enter, to come in.
Yeah.
And the word
reside
used,
in.
it was also used as to consult or to come before of a court.
Yeah.
And here I translated approached.
Okay.
The adversary had approached Judas.
Okay.
All right. And that's, I did that purposely in order to show that a supernatural event, including some spiritual Satan, is not necessarily inferred here.
Okay.
The adversary here may have been any one of those in Judea who were opposed to Christ and who had long been plotting against him.
Right, right.
The same exact word is used, for instance, in Luke 1:28, where a messenger of Yahweh entered into Mary.
Okay.
Okay, and it's the same language.
Uh-huh.
And in other words, he went into her house and spoke to her.
Okay.
And that can be the picture here also.
Okay.
The language
but
does.
In any case, Judas, being the only Idumean of the 12.
Oh, yeah. It. I mean, we can get a spiritual event from it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, right.
But
sure.
I'm just saying that the language does not necessitate it.
Yes. Okay, yeah. No, understood. But the fact that Judas was the only Idumean, all the other apostles were Benjaminites.
Right. Have I not chosen you 12, and one of you is a devil?
One of you is a devil, right.
And that was definitely Judas being spoken about.
Right. Okay, very good. So verse 4, he went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them. Okay, so the devil goes to this devil, this particular devil, goes to his devil masters, okay, and they were glad and engaged to give him money. So he agreed and sought an opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. Well, Jews don't do anything like that today, do they?
That's all they do today. They never do anything in public venues the way they should be done.
It's all bribery, thievery, and deception.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Verse 7. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat it." Then they said to him, "Where will you have us prepare it?" He said to them, "Behold, when you have entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you." Before I continue, have any comments on this episode here of a man carrying a jar of water?
Well, this shows, you know, that Christ knew these things and laid this account out like this. It definitely shows a divine inspiration.
Yes.
And the apostles didn't, this was not embellished.
Right.
It's too simple and straightforward an account to be an embellishment.
Okay. Okay. Follow him into the house which he enters and tell the householder, "The teacher says to you, where is the guest room? Where am I to eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished. There, make ready." So what he told them, all these things came to pass. Okay. Verse 13. And they went and found it as he had told them. And they prepared the Passover. Verse 14. And when the hour came, he sat at table and the apostles with him. And he said to them, "I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." Now, to me, this verse is really important.
Well, it's before that which I am to suffer. And yes, it definitely implies that He knew what was about to happen.
Yes, he knew what was about to happen. But also, because he anticipated, this is the moment at which the new covenant is supposed to be transferred to Israel. And so this is the big moment here. This is it. Okay? Verse 16. "For I tell you, I shall not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." All right? Then we're talking about the second stage of this. You concur with that on verse 16 here?
Well, I have no argument against it.
Yeah, okay, and obviously, you know, we're talking about two Advents, and the entire plan could not be.
It has to intone a second Advent. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. The entire plan cannot be completed until both Advents take place. Verse 17, and he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he said, "Take this and divide it among yourselves, for I tell you that from now on I shall not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes." What is this drinking of the fruit of the vine?
Well, it's wine. It's definitely wine. It's alcoholic wine. And he's saying that from now, from this time, he's not going to drink it.
Right. Okay. Well, that's the literal meaning. What about the fact that he will not incarnate as a physical person of the blood of the Israel race until he comes again.
Well, I believe that he can't incarnate again because his first body really didn't die.
Okay. All right.
You know, I don't believe that when he comes back, we're told explicitly that he's coming back the exact same way we saw him leave.
Yeah. Okay. So you take this purely literally. All right. Very good. Verse 19, and he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, "This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Okay, so
in other words, split the bread up and divide it in remembrance of him.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to assume that we're going to recreate his body in the mystical way that the ritualistic Catholic Church does it.
Yeah, certainly not. Certainly not, because
which is just ridiculous.
Right, and because he only died once, and he doesn't die every time they sacrifice the Mass, okay?
Right,
yes,
which they would like him to do, probably.
Right.
So that they can keep their control.
Yes, right. But we are to do this in remembrance of him, okay, and whenever we break bread, not just when we go to church, right?
Well, right, and the example I give all the time is this one. How did Christ give his communion?
Mm-hmm.
With a group of his loved ones and friends sitting around a table. Every meal that we eat, as Paul says,
yes,
we do in his memory.
That's right.
And breaking bread and sharing that bread and sharing that wine, that is the communion.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say that, you know, even though we have literal wine and the literal bread here, the real blood and body of Christ are the people sitting around the table.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Okay, so, and then likewise, the cup after supper, saying, "This cup which is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." Okay, here's the new covenant, folks. "But behold, the hand of him who betrays me is with me at this table, for the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed." So, unfortunately, Judas is the guy who represents these Edomites that put him to death.
Well, unfortunately for Judas, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. He's the representative of the serpent here.
Right. So, and now we have to understand, I'm trying to see if I have a reference to the Old Testament here in verse 20 here. Let me quickly scan this. I don't have one here. But obviously the New Covenant, the New Covenant was prophesied in the Old Testament in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 37.
Absolutely.
Also in Daniel 9, where he says, "The sacrifices and the oblations shall cease."
Yes, it did.
Okay. This is all coming together right here.
Yes, it is.
This is the big moment. Okay. Now, so let's continue. "And they began to question one another which of them it was that would do this. A dispute also arose among them, which of them was to be regarded as the greatest." Okay. No humility there.
Right? None whatsoever.
Yeah. "And he said to them, the kings of the nations exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader as one who serves." Okay?
And so, that should be the example that we have today.
Right.
And all the pomp and the circumstance of the churches and all the churches and the synagogues are
yes,
guilty of this.
That's right.
I mean, it's all shown to be vain.
Yes.
It's all 100% vain.
Yes.
It could never be the true religion.
Right, right.
So because all they are about self-elevation.
Right, right. And so here the apostles are pantomiming the Catholic Church, the rabbinate, and all the various, I mean, look at the Hindus. You know, to some extent, the Buddhists are just as bad, even though they claim to be humble, yet they make a big to-do about their priesthood, okay? Even though they, you know, would afflict themselves in various ways all the time. Yet they,
well, right, but they do that as a pretense.
Right, of course.
All that garbage is
yeah,
pretense.
Right.
Oh, look at how holy I am.
Yeah,
oy,
right,
oy, oy, as they're whipping themselves.
And certainly the Dalai Lama, is held up on a pedestal.
And he's just a fraud.
That's right.
they're just
right,
self-promoting fraud.
Yeah, Buddhism, I mean, Hinduism is probably the absolute worst. They have nothing but everywhere you turn around, there's idols and there's painted objects.
I used to have disputes with a Buddhist.
Okay.
All right? And his name was Monk. And he was actually he went by. I can't remember his real name. Everybody
right.
called him Monk.
Okay.
He was actually a drummer for a rock band.
Okay.
All right. And he ended up in prison for drugs. And he became a Buddhist.
Right.
And he started writing this leader of this Buddhist cult here in America.
All right.
And this leader of this Buddhist cult was going to come see him.
And
he was all excited for like a year that this leader of this Buddhist cult was coming to see him because he was going to tell him who he was.
Oh, okay.
And you know, they have all these prison named Monk. Right. The Dalai Lama is only one of the lamas.
Yeah.
You know, there's dozens and dozens or hundreds of them.
Right.
They all know each other.
The lame asses.
Yeah, basically. And this Buddhist monk was going to tell him who he was.
Okay.
And when he got done visiting him, he was very disappointed he didn't tell him who he was. It broke his faith. He was destroyed. He wasn't a Buddhist
anymore.
Well,
good.
He couldn't tell him which of the great lamas he was because he was somebody great that reincarnated.
Right.
It's all a fraud. It's right. I made fun of this guy for 5 years.
Yeah.
He just never got it.
I believe you. Yeah, well, this is the kind of nonsense that these other religions, you know, obviously Christianity gets in all kinds of nonsense, too.
And I had always got the impression that if he had enough money to give this guy, he'd have told him anything.
Right. And he would have believed it, too.
Yes, he would have absolutely believed it.
So verse 27, for which is the greater, one who sits at table or one who serves? Well, that should be obvious to a Anglo-Israel Christian, right?
Right.
The one
you want
serves.
To be the one serving. You
That's
want to
right.
help your brethren.
Right.
And that's, you know, the table is a metaphor, but, I mean, this is life. That
yes.
table is life.
Right, right.
And you should always be seeking to do, you should be seeking to do good, and most Christians wake up in the morning seeking to feel good.
Right.
But you should be seeking to do good.
Yes, yes.
And to help your brethren.
Well, the way to feel good is to do good, right?
Right, and you want to be the one serving.
Right. And so here, you know, again, this contrasts very strongly with the gospel of personal gratification, in which those very same Christians who should be getting up inclined to do good want to just feel good. And therefore they read books by, Joel Osteen and Joyce Meyer and Paula White and all those characters who, are basically in the business of making Christians feel good about themselves, right? Isn't that what it is?
Well, absolutely. It's a perfect religion for the Jewish consumer economy.
There you go.
Go buy more toys. Send me more money.
Mm-hmm.
And God's going to bless you, and you'll be able to buy that speedboat next week.
Yeah. And there's a verse by Paul somewhere that says, where he describes the Christians of the future as ever learning but never achieving. Doesn't that describe Judeo-Christians, especially those who follow the televangelist perfectly?
Well, it's
yeah.
They're
constantly buying more and more books, the new fads being created, you know, the purpose-driven church, you know.
Right,
they come
it's
up with new fads.
Plague.
The fad lasts 20, 30 years, depending how long it plays out on television, you know. And then somebody comes up with a new fad, and the Christians jump on a new fad bandwagon.
One after another,
exactly. Verse 27, for which is the greater, one who sits at the table or one who serves? Is it not the one who sits at the table? But I am among you as one who serves.
There we have it. The greatest one of us is serving us.
That's right, folks. There's a lesson here. Okay. Verse 28. You are those who have continued with me in my trials, and I assign to you. Okay. Now here's another.
Oh, so I delegate to you.
Yes, that's good. Assign is okay. Delegate is better, yes. So let me read it that way. And I delegate to you, as my Father assigned to me or delegated to me, a kingdom. Not
Absolutely.
A church.
Absolutely.
A kingdom. That you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom. There's that word again. And sit on thrones. judging the 12 tribes of Israel.
And only the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right. And not the rest of the world. Okay. At this point, I would like to turn to Revelation 21, verses 7 through 14, to amplify that this is about Israel, that is us, the Caucasian Israelites of this planet, and not about the entire world. Verse 7, he who conquers shall have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, oh baby, the polluted, as for murderers, fornicators, sorcerers, idolaters,
that's pharmacists.
Yeah, there you go. And all liars, their lot shall be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. He just loves everybody, doesn't he? Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Now listen closely, folks. And in the spirit, he carried me away to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels, and on the gates of the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel.
Nobody else need apply.
Yes, that's right. The heavenly kingdom, folks, that's coming down to earth will be administrated by the 12 tribes of Israel. Where was I? Okay, getting back to the book of Luke, chapter
verse 29.
Okay,
verse 31.
I just read 30. Here we go, verse 31. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to you to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brethren. What does this mean here, turned again? That's kind of an odd phrase. This is, again, the Revised Standard
Version. And
when
you have turned about, in other words, when you finally wake the hell up.
Okay.
Because we know that Peter was the most stubborn of apostles.
Right, right, right. And, you know, and I would say that Peter, actually, of all the apostles, was both, you know, susceptible to personal delusions, okay? Maybe because he had the greatest faith, maybe, okay? Because, you know, we like to think that we're all really strong and powerful in the faith, you know, and then when the time comes for the test, as he proved, he was really unable to deliver at the time. Yet, if you don't have that kind of faith, you're not going to get anywhere either, okay? So it's a process. You know, you believe, you have faith, and then you test yourself. But if you never test yourself, if you never get tested, what do you have? Nothing.
Right, you don't know what you have.
You don't know what you have.
Have nothing.
So always
you're not.
Yeah, always.
It's like a dollar you can't spend, right?
Right. It's buried in the pocket of some pants in your closet. You can't spend it. You know, and so this is the gripe that I have with the Judeo-Christians today. Those who think that you don't have to perform, you don't have to, put your faith into practice. That's the word I'm looking for. You don't have to practice your faith. You just have to believe.
And you should have to practice it every waking moment.
That's right.
You should practice your faith.
That's right.
Now, I'd like to say something else about this verse.
Okay.
In contrast to what I said earlier about the Satan entering into Judas.
Okay.
You know, here it says, Simon, Simon, behold, the adversary has demanded you.
Yes.
For which to winnow you his grain. And here it certainly does seem as if there is a greater struggle transpiring in the spiritual realm.
Okay, yes.
Because the adversary demanded Peter in order to try him is first highly reminiscent of the story of Job.
Yes.
And his trial.
Right.
As it was initiated by the devil.
Yes.
Or the false accuser, Diabolos,
right.
Described
yes.
in Job chapter 1.
Yes.
Now, secondly, I don't think that some kike just walked up to Christ and said, hey, why don't you let me, you know, get the one over there to come with me and my buddies.
Yeah, he'd say get away anyhow. Yeah,
you know what I mean? There's something more going on here.
Right, right.
And there's, you know, the adversary demanded you to, I believe that is a spiritual.
Right. Well, I think what it illustrates here between verses 3 and 31, and verse 3 being where Judas was tempted, okay, Judas wasn't even tempted.
Oh, and no,
Satan
Judas
just went into it.
That was a done deal, right.
Yeah.
That wasn't a trial.
No.
And that also has to be contrasted. You're right.
Yes.
That was just, you know, Judas was one of them.
Right.
You know, he just had to be told what to do. And it wasn't the problem. Where Peter would never do that on purpose, he might be pressured into denying Christ as he was.
Okay.
But he would never turn on him and join the enemy
readily
as Judas did.
Yeah, and verse 31 and 32 are implying that we Israelites have the power to turn Satan back, whereas Judas did not have that ability.
Exactly.
Yes.
The devil is always going to follow the ways of his father.
Right. There's a question on the screen. Gerald is listening in by phone. He says that there's some problems with the audio. Let me know, people in the chat room, if you're having audio problems online, just let me know. I think we're doing okay. I haven't gotten any other complaints this evening, okay? All right, so let's continue, verse 33. And he said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you to prison and to death. Okay, well, here's that spiritual confidence that we were talking about earlier, verse 34. And he said, I tell you, Peter, the cock will not crow this day until you three times deny that you know me. Okay, so again, here's another prophecy. Okay, verse 35. And he said to them, when I sent you out with no purse or bag or sandals, did you lack anything? They said nothing. He said to them, but now let him who has a purse take it, and likewise a bag. And let him who has no sword sell his mantle and buy one. Okay, so now are we talking about a change in times that the protection of the Holy Spirit, which was upon these apostles while Jesus yet lived, is not going to be as strong after he departs?
Well, it seems to me there's definitely a change, yes.
Yes.
And they had no care the first time they went out, but now they'd better be weary.
Right. And so, but doesn't this verse also fly in the face of the Christian pacifist who says, well, we should just submit, not complain about evil? Why
exactly.
Would he tell?
Exactly. We have to face evil.
Yes.
Even, you know, we're to forgive our brethren.
Yes.
Period.
Resist
that's
not the evil of our brethren.
The people of our own race who are repentant, we have to forgive. They have to be repentant to be forgiven. But with the other races, they have nothing coming.
Huh.
The Edomites have nothing coming. The other races have nothing coming. They have no forgiveness coming. They can't do anything to me without there being repercussions. Of course I'm gonna fight them back.
Yes. Yes, and so he obviously tells, and then we quoted the verse earlier where Yahshua says, bring those who would not submit to my dominion before me and slay them. Okay.
Right, there's the enemies of God, and there's our personal enemies.
Yeah.
We are to be kind and forgiving and gracious to our racial kinsmen.
That's right.
That's where it ends.
Right.
The Negroes, the Spiggers, I saw that word. I used to use that word all the time when I was a kid. I thought it was funny. The
you didn't
Orientals,
learn that in prison?
The Edomites. No, I learned that on the streets of Jersey City.
Okay.
The
all
those other races, they have nothing coming. They have no forgiveness coming.
Yes.
I mean, with them, it's an eye for an eye.
Uh-huh.
There's no forgiving them. That's crazy. That's giving your chattels to your enemy and to the enemies of your God.
Well, I mean, it's obvious that the attempts by the Judeo-Christians to appease the blacks of Africa are being, it's coming. Cast ye not pearls before swine, lest they turn again and rend you.
Right, and there's another verse in the Ecclesiasticus and the Septuagint I like to cite, and I think it's Ecclesiastes 12:6,
okay,
where he who gives his bread to God's enemies will pay for it four times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He'll pay for it fourfold.
Yes, yes. And outside of the kingdom are dogs and whoremongers and all kinds of evil things. Revelation 22, okay? So, folks, you're either in the kingdom or you're outside the kingdom. So we have to decide as Christian Israelites where we want to be, okay? Where we want to be. Verse 37, "For I tell you that this scripture must be fulfilled in me. And he was reckoned with the transgressors," Isaiah 53:12, I believe, "for what it is written about me has its fulfillment." In other words, here we go, prophecy again. "For what is written about me must be fulfilled."
Right, that's absolutely prophecy again. And yes, that is Isaiah 53:12.
Okay.
And he is, again, that this is proven not to be an idle boast.
That's right.
And for him to be able to say this and it happened, well, it has to be divine inspiration.
Right. And John
God
Hagee,
of the Bible has to be God.
Right. And John Hagee can't deny it. Okay.
Well, John Hagee is just a circus clown.
That's right.
He's in ring number one
Jewish
right now.
Circus. That's
absolutely.
Television. Yeah.
He's ring number one, and Benny Hinn's ring number two.
Yeah, right. Right.
Pat Robertson might still be in ring number three. I don't know.
Three-ring circus. There you go. And they said, well, how many networks are there? That's how many rings we have in this circus. And they said, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough." And he came out and went as was his custom to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed, "Father, if thou art willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done." Of course, he's showing his humanness. I think anybody incarnated in a physical body anticipating his torture and death imminently coming would feel this way. Verse 45, "And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, 'Why do you sleep? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation.'" Okay, of course, he's speaking to them directly, but here's another metaphor that's true for all Israel. How many Israelites are asleep today?
Right, and we have a few things to talk about here.
Okay.
And first, I'd like to say about the swords, I think the two swords are also a parable for the Old and New Testament.
Okay.
He said the two swords are sufficient.
Yes.
And that might be good enough for two men to defend themselves.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Romans and the Edomites had thousands of swords.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So
yes.
I think that that's symbolic of that.
Yes.
But that's
very
beside
good.
The point. It's Psalm 116:13 in the Septuagint. I'm sorry, Psalm 116:13 or 115:13 in the Septuagint.
Okay.
"I will take the cup of salvation and call upon the name of Yahweh." I just wanted to quote that in relation to this, you know, "Father, if you wish, turn this cup away from me."
Okay.
And what I believe is going on here is that Christ is setting two examples. One, that by always praying, we always, and you know, he says to the apostles, "Pray that you not enter into temptation." By always praying, we always have Yahweh and the word of God on our minds, and therefore we are not led astray by the temptations of life, because we're always meditating on him. And two, that even if you were the Christ, whom I am certain is Yahweh himself incarnated as a man, it is the will of Yahweh and his word which must prevail, and not our own personal desires.
Yes, certainly.
And that's the example he sets forth.
Mm-hmm.
He sets forth here, even if it means that we have to suffer greatly.
Right.
That the will of God must prevail.
Well,
now as you said, the continual falling asleep by the apostles, I think, is a warning to us.
Yes.
Of how difficult it is to maintain Christian vigilance in this world.
Right, absolutely.
And how easy it is to be caught up in
right,
worldly things.
Right. But getting back to verse 42, "Not my will, but thine be done," we're talking about the law. You know, there's no other possibility. What other will could there be?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's part of it. It's the law and the prophets and everything that he has to face. But, yeah, see, he followed the law.
Yeah.
That was his example.
And so we're expected to believe, you know, here's a few hours from death, okay? And we're expected to believe, according to the antinomians, that this statement, this very profound statement here, will cease to have any effect when he dies on the cross.
Now I noticed that you skipped 43 and 44 here.
I did?
Yes.
Wait a minute. They're not in here. Please
read
them.
Well, that's good, because they're not in my translation either.
Are they in the King James? Because, again, I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version.
Well, they're verses 43 and 44. If they weren't in the King James, they wouldn't be verses.
I guess you're right. Let me see
that's
here.
That's why your version goes from 42 to 45, right?
Yeah, let me see here. Okay. All right, so verse in the King James now. And there appeared an angel to him from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. Are those the two verses you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
And they're spurious, those verses.
Okay.
And that's why I wanted to call them to attention
and
notice that you skipped over them.
Well, it's
they're actually not – they're really not that spurious, because they're in the Codex Sinaiticus.
Okay.
And they're in the Codex Bazai. And the Codex Sinaiticus is – It's one of the two great oldest and best codices.
Yeah.
With you know, the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus.
Okay.
The Codex Bazai is I often call it the Codex Bizarre.
Okay.
It's actually the only codex. It's a 5th century codex that has a lot of departures in it.
All right.
And they're in the Masoretic text, but they're not in some of the ancient papyri. And they're not in the Codex Alexandrinus or the Codex Vaticanus.
Yes.
So it seems to me that they're definitely spurious, and some ancestor of the Codex Sinaiticus may have interpolated them.
Okay. Or, what's the other possibility that these verses were somehow deleted from the other two and retained by the Sinaiticus?
They'd have to be deleted from the Alexandrinus, from the Vaticanus. And there's one very old papyri, P75,
okay.
And I think that's 3rd or 4th century. I don't know. Let me look here. It's going to take me a second to look up the antiquity of that papyri,
so
and I have it right
not out of
here.
The question, but you're saying it's pretty unlikely that those would have been deleted from those manuscripts.
Well, P75 dates to the 3rd century, that papyri.
Okay.
So they're not in that papyri. They're not in the Codex Alexandrinus, which is a 5th century codex, and which is a separate tradition than the Codex Vaticanus or the Codex Sinaiticus.
Okay.
So we have it being deleted from multiple branches of the textual tradition.
Yes.
So I would much safer assume it appeared in the Sinaiticus and the Bazai.
Right. And it's very interesting, in my Revised Standard Version, it goes from verse 42, Father, if thou art willing, to verse 45.
Well, right. They also recognize that the verses were serious.
Yeah, but they chose to delete them without comment here. Oh, well, wait a minute. Okay. There is a comment here. Other ancient authorities add verses 43 and 44, and they'll go ahead and quote them, but without any explanation as to why they're deleted here or why they were added in other versions. So no discussion of that at all. Okay. Very, very interesting. Okay, verse 47. While he was still speaking, there came a crowd, and the man called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? But did he kiss him or didn't he? Because most people believe that he actually did kiss him, whereas from this verse it says, wait a minute, you're not going to kiss me.
Well, it says that he
approached
Yahshua
to kiss
him.
Yes.
All right, but it doesn't say that he actually did.
Right.
But it was common. It was a common greeting.
Yeah.
Back then.
Right.
I mean, Paul tells men to, greet one another with a holy kiss. I mean, they didn't swap spit.
Yeah, right.
In today's colloquy. they
like
kissed each other on the cheek. A lot, the Sicilians do it all the time.
Yeah.
And I grew up around a lot of Sicilians, and in Sicilian neighborhoods in Jersey City, they did it all the time, and nobody thought anything bad about
it. Right.
And me being an Anglo-Irish kid with a bunch of Sicilians, I didn't dare say anything bad about it. But nah, it was a normal part of culture. You know, a kiss on the cheek was a normal part of the culture.
Yeah.
And it wasn't anything odd, except that Judas is about to betray him, and he's like, well, why are you kissing me?
Right,
you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, get away from me, you Sicilian.
Well, right. Yeah, exactly.
Verse 49. And when those who were about him saw what would follow, they said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? And one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus said, no more of this. And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had come out against him, have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness. I like this translation.
Well, yeah, that's actually pretty good.
Uh-huh.
And I have authority of darkness, but that's okay.
Okay.
It's always overlooked the healing of the servant of the high priest's ear.
Uh-huh.
You know, that this happened in the crowd.
Yes.
I mean, they must have all seen it. But the Edomites didn't care.
Right.
They just wanted to kill him.
Right.
They didn't care that he just performed this miracle.
Mm-hmm.
Just healed this man's ear just by touching it.
Yes. Yes.
And he still couldn't hear. But
sure.
It's just overlooked. It's not even ignored by the Edomites. And that alone shows how focused they are on evil.
Yeah, and how they can't be converted because elsewhere he says, though they would not be converted, though one rose from the dead.
Well, right. And if they could be converted, there wouldn't be any tares for the fire.
Right. There you go. Verse 54. Then they seized him and led him away, bringing him into the high priest's house. Peter followed at a distance. And when they had kindled a fire in the middle of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them. Then a maid, seeing him as he sat in the light and gazing at him, said, this man also was with him, of course, meaning Jesus, but he denied it, saying, woman, I do not know him. And a little later, someone else saw him and said, you also are one of them. But Peter said, man, I am not. And after an interval of about an hour, still another insisted, saying, certainly this man also was with him, for he is a Galilean. Okay.
Now, in one of the other Gospels, I think it's Matthew, it's either Matthew or Mark, it says that he was betrayed as a Galilean because of his accent.
Uh-huh.
Because of the way he spoke.
Right.
And that isn't evident here in Luke, but it's surely a part of the record.
Yes.
And that, you know, he spoke Hebrew and not Yiddish, probably.
Yes. Exactly. Okay.
He didn't spit while he was speaking.
Yeah. He didn't chutzpah enough. But Peter said, man, I do not know what you are saying. And immediately, while he was still speaking, the cock crowed. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, before the cock crows today, you will deny me three times. And he went out and wept bitterly. I would, too.
He was told that he would do something bad, and he went and did it anyway.
Yeah,
he didn't even realize he was doing it.
Yeah, he forgot
until it was done.
Well, yeah, he got caught in a moment, and he saw all these people getting ready to hang him, okay? The Messiah getting ready to be, what he obviously couldn't predict what was getting ready to happen, but it was very evil, and, he probably felt alone and terrified, really. So.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, he was definitely a sheep amongst the wolves.
Yes.
I mean, there's no doubt about it.
Yes.
Peter, I pity Peter because he had to go through everything three times.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
You know, Acts chapter 10, in order for him to get it, he had to be told three times about the vision. You know,
right.
You know, the vision of the sheep.
Yes.
Of the sheet that came down from heaven. He
mm-hmm.
had to, that happened to him three times.
Yeah.
Now, at the end of the Gospel of John, three times Yahshua asked Peter, do you love me? And he started to get irritated by it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I love you.
Yeah.
Well, feed my sheep.
Right.
And he had to be told three times.
Yes, right.
So Peter is, that's three threes.
Yes.
You know, and it shows that he must have been
right.
the typical thick-headed redneck.
Right. Well, I've never really thought about this before, but as you're saying these things, it appears to me it could symbolize the three stages, the three revivals of Christianity. The first one, of course, was the initial, from the crucifixion till the Catholic Church or the Constantinian perversion of Christianity, okay, the paganization of Christianity, okay, that's phase number one. Phase number two would be the Reformation revival, under Martin Luther and others of the, great saints that's beginning to throw off the Catholic crutch, okay? And now what we're going through today is the Christian identity revival.
Well, we hope.
Yeah.
I mean, we only have hope, but that's a possibility.
Give me some hope here, Bill.
well, I'm being pragmatic.
Yes.
But we are, I mean... Christian identity people are, so far as I can imagine, outside of the Amish are racially exclusive by accident.
Okay, yes.
Okay?
There's no black
if they
ones
could
going
have
like
boom
them.
Boxes, if they could have boom boxes and,
right.
and discos,
yeah,
then
right.
that, you know, they'd be invaded tomorrow.
Yeah, right. Right. And the Mexicans live like that in Mexico, but they don't want to live like that in America. Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the amongst Christians, I mean, Christian identity is the only faith that I see actually at least most of the adherents try to
yes
obey the word.
That's right,
and that's not even close anywhere else.
Yes, yeah, and Fist of Yahweh prefers to call it racial covenant identity. That's fine. The word identity to me is rather critical, and because it's about our identity, who we are, But
well, to
Christian
me, it's
is
about
another term. Yeah.
To me, it's about, I like to call it Christian Israel identity.
Okay.
Clifton prefers Israel identity. It doesn't matter to me. I'm not going to let the nut jobs in amongst us.
Yeah, so you have to use this or you have to use that. Yeah.
Well, either tell me that or be the ones that Christian identity, the term is relegated to. I'm not going to let them steal the label.
Right, right. And
you know?
And I know some people, while they're starting to demonize the word Christian identity, but whatever label we choose for ourselves will be demonized.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And to me, Christian identity just intones that we identify
yeah.
the parties of the Bible.
That's right.
And
that's
that
right.
doesn't mean just the sheep.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to identify the goats and the
that's
devils,
right.
too.
Yes, exactly.
They're all part yeah. of the equation.
So the concept of the true identity of Israel is really crucial in our movement, and therefore the word identity, I don't see how we can drop it. I think
right, and I often write Christian Israel identity.
Yeah, or just Christian Israel is fine too, because the true Israelites are the Christians, not Jews.
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Verse 63. Now, and we might as well just take it to the end of chapter 22. Now the men who were holding Jesus mocked him and beat him. They also blindfolded him and asked him, "Prophesy. Who is it that struck you?" And they spoke many other words against him, reviling him. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council. And they said, "If you are the Christ, the anointed one, or the anointed, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." And all they said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said, "You say that I am." I'll just read it to the end and you can comment here. And they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." Did
now,
he say, "I am the Son of God"?
Now, I believe that they understood it by the terms Christ and Son of God.
Uh-huh.
That would mean that he was claiming to be Yahweh in the flesh.
Right.
Because Isaiah 9, "Unto us a child is born of a virgin, and he will be called the Everlasting Father," and
mm-hmm.
"he would be called God," or whatever.
And repeated in Luke 1:68, as I recall. We covered that earlier at the beginning of Luke. Yeah.
Right. Now what the Old Testament prophecies say that he had to die. And if he stops and explains to them who he is,
yeah.
well, how could he die? Or how could they believe him?
Right.
To explain it is just vain.
Yeah. Well, plus these people, the Pharisees, were primarily Edomites, and they could care less about what was prophesied.
Well, right. And they probably didn't know it because he proved to them all the time that they didn't know Scripture.
Yes, right.
They didn't read it.
That's
Today's
right.
priests don't read it.
Okay. I just have one question here on verse 67, because as translated, it says, if you are the Christ. Okay, is that article
and
there
that's
in
exactly
the
That's exactly what it says, saying, if you are the Christ,
okay.
tell us.
Okay, the anointed, yes. Okay, so there, you know, there can't be any mistake what they're asking him.
Oh, no.
Yes.
They're asking him, are you the anointed one?
Yeah,
if
are
you
the anointed
one? Tell
yes.
us.
Because often we've come into situations where the anointed is translated as Christ when it shouldn't be, when it should simply be translated as simply anointed, referring to the anointed race of Israel, not to the Christ.
Right, but this, you know, the article's there, but often it's there in the other cases also.
Okay,
and,
right.
And it, you can only tell what Paul means by the context.
But, so it still requires the context. But the essence of this, the anointed or anointed as it is often used in the New Testament, it does not always refer to Messiah himself. It sometimes refers to the people of Israel. And the King James translators and probably the RSV translators get this wrong very often.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And here, if that was what the speakers meant, then the word would probably appear in the genitive, and it
okay.
doesn't.
Yeah, of course, but they're speaking to him as a person. So in this case, it can't be talking about people, the Israel people in general. So
right, but Paul often uses the term of the anointed,
uh-huh.
in the genitive case,
okay,
which means belonging to
yes.
the anointed,
yes.
as well as it does, you know, of
yes.
Christ.
Yes.
So it could be interpreted two ways, where this really can't be interpreted two ways.
Right.
Because it's not in the genitive
yeah.
case.
And as we found in the book of Galatians, the King James translators got this wrong on several occasions, translating it as the Christ when it actually was a reference to the people of Israel. So, and you know, so that becomes very confusing when it's translated in improperly. So
right.
It's nice that it's translated correctly here. Of course, it's hard to get this one wrong.
Okay. Well, absolutely. It's in a nominative case, by the way.
Okay.
And that means it's translated correctly on its face. It's yes. you are the Christ, the anointed one. Totally.
Uh-huh. Yeah. All right. So, folks, this is Luke chapter 22. Next week we'll get into Luke chapter 23, and we'll see how many episodes are required to get to the end of Luke, and then we'll decide where to go from there. But this has been tremendous fun so far in demonstrating that the book of Luke is indeed a very exclusivist, two-seed line document once you understand the contexts of the various chapters and the fact that the Israelites of depicted in the book of Luke clearly see themselves as a separate, distinct people from the Edomites and from all other people that are involved, you know, that happen to be living in Jerusalem at this time. All right. Anything else from you, Bill?
No, I'm good.
All right, excellent.
I'll see you next week, or actually I'll see you tomorrow. Or...
Yeah, that's right, on Yahweh's Covenant People. I'm not sure if I'm going to be around next weekend, but, you know, we'll take care of that as the time comes. So, folks, thanks for listening. This is what is tonight's show again? Christogenos Show, which means the race of Christ, okay? And we'll be here next Friday night, tomorrow, Yahweh's Covenant People. And Sunday on Voice of Christian Israel, we'll have part two with Arthur Jones, and this time we'll be getting into the history of how the communists won World War II. That'll be Sunday at 11 Central, okay? So thanks for listening. It's a pleasure and loads of fun dissecting the scriptures from the correct context. Praise Yahweh, and Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Bye-bye.